From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Colin Donovan. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
A tremendous All Saints Day to each and every one of you. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line. Our very own Vice President of Theology, Mr. Colin Donovan, is in the house. If you've got a question for Colin, the number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, your number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. You can always send us an email. That email address is openline@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams, Michael McCall producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Gubensky and Ace McKay handling our social media efforts. So if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, you can type a question into the chat window and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host, the aforementioned Colin Donovan, and I must say, Colin, you've carried All Hallows Eve into All Saints Day, and you have nailed the middle-aged theologian costume, I'm telling you.
Oh, you thought that was good?
Yeah.
Was it? Not too pudgy around the middle?
You pulled it off.
Well, of course, it's that would be perfect. A Thomas Aquinas costume, wouldn't it?
Sue writes in, why are there people that reject the third secret of Fatima?
I don't think they reject it. They reject that it's been fulfilled or satisfied or properly understood by the church. They do that for a number of grounds. Basically, they read the text and they conclude based on the text that they haven't been fulfilled. But Sister Lucia herself has said that it has been fulfilled. In some of her own correspondence and conversations with spiritual directors in the 40s or 50s, she made it clear that she didn't quibble over these kinds of points when she was asked, because everything is taken into account in God's providence, and therefore that was not a concern to her. And yet she affirmed that the fall of the Soviet Union, she didn't affirm it at the time, but she affirmed it within a couple years of the 1984 consecration, that that God had accepted the consecration of Russia undercover, so to speak, of the world and those nations which especially needed consecrated, the Pope intending Russia and the Soviet bloc nations in doing that, and that he would respond. And indeed, we know from the rapid fires of events in the course of the period of 1984 to 1989, from the destruction of submarine munitions and of rocket engines at various factories in the Soviet Union, and the general dissolution of the nations in those respects, and the deaths of at least two, maybe it was three, of the leaders of the Soviet Union, finally leading to Gorbachev, who in 19 brought down the wall, and in 1991 dissolved the Soviet Union. So it's clear that God heard that prayer, and it's clear by him having heard it that the purpose of the promises made at Fatima were not simply for our material peace and prosperity and goodwill and our good in the face of earthly enemies, but especially in view of the purpose that was stated by Our Lady to establish devotion in the world to the Immaculate Heart, alongside that to the Sacred Heart. And we see more and more the degree to which that has been accomplished in the use of consecrations, Pope Francis used it in the context of Russia and Ukraine in our own day. We're still hoping for great fruit from that, although it hasn't occurred, but this is all in God's time and in his providence. But for those who blame the church for the delays in responding to the message of Fatima, and no doubt God will have those whom he wishes to blame for such things, they would not have not accepted that. And so there are still those who are waiting for that consecration to be done properly in their definition of properly.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Sam wants to know, is there the equivalent of an annulment for the priesthood?
No, there is no such thing as an annulment. Well, actually, I guess you could say there would be. There would be a case, if you take what an annulment is, it's a decree that a marriage never existed from the beginning. The Holy See, and specifically it would be the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, could conclude in the case of a particular man that the consecration, that his priestly ordination was invalid. It would be invalid because of the form and so on which it took, or some other reason. For the same reason Pope Leo XIII said, for a similar reason, Leo XIII said Anglican orders were invalid because they didn't, from the time of the Elizabethan era, have the correct understanding of what a priest, a sacerdote, who offers sacrifice. So they understood it ministerially, but not in a priestly way. That could be also done with individuals, an invalidity of individuals. I can think of a case where someone was ordained and a relative who was troubled by the all-male priesthood said that she at least was happy that he didn't believe in that hocus-pocus stuff. Well, if that was the case, I would question the validity of those orders, that he didn't bring the intention. If the intention is to ordain someone to the sacrificial priesthood and the man does not have the intention, the will to be ordained to the sacrificial priesthood, then is he not in the same condition as the man who does not will to marry this woman for life with the intentions for which, with the purposes for which marriage is established, unity and procreation? So those kinds of things can be judged by Rome. And so in that sense, there could be a nullity decree declaring that these orders are not invalid. There have been such, and we've seen this in recent years, where there was some question raised and there was a response done where there was some claim that somebody was not properly ordained. I think it was to the diaconate in a couple cases, and the bishop quickly covered that all up. And not in the sense of covering it up so it wouldn't be known, but fixing it. So those cases can and have occurred, and usually there is some defect there. I think this was a particular case, was not the ordination so much as the question of the validity of their baptism was at risk. And somebody who is not baptized can't be confirmed, can't receive Eucharist, can't be ordained to the diaconate, can't be ordained to the priesthood of the episcopacy. So that would be fatal for holy orders, for all three stages of holy orders. And that has occurred in the last several years in a couple cases. And nobody was at fault, at least none of the principals, not the individual, the man himself. And it was quickly, you know, properly baptized, properly ordained to the diaconate, properly ordained to the priesthood. And the mistake and the fault was solved in that way. So that was not a question of any kind of fraud, but a question of a defect at the root of that Christian life, because had not been baptized into the Catholic faith at the very beginning of his life.
We're just getting started on a Friday edition of EWTN's Open Line. Our very own Vice President of Theology, Mr. Colin Donovan, is here to answer your questions. Straight ahead, we'll talk to Linda in Olympia, Washington, and we've got some wide open phone lines for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, we'd still love to hear from you. That number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. And you can always send us an email. That email address is openline@ewtn.com. It's EWTN's Open Line Friday with our very own Vice President of Theology, Mr. Colin Donovan.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
Turn to Mary, the Mother of God, for help bearing witness to the gift of life with the National Life Rosary. It's designed exclusively for EWTN. The unique centerpiece and crucifix represent the reality that all life is sacred and begins at conception. Help pray for and build a culture of life with the National Life Rosary, available now at EWTNRC.com. As advertised, we head to the phones. Linda is up first in Olympia, Washington, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Linda, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm good. What's your question today, Linda?
Well, my question is, what is the dark night of the soul?
Okay, well, it's part of the purification process by which we are prepared for eternal life, prepared to, you know, face to face God in cleansed and purified of all sin and its consequences and effects. If we don't accomplish it in this life, it will be accomplished for us in the next life in purgatory. Now, in and of itself, the dark night of the soul is the second of two purifications, which is commonly spoken of in spiritual writers. John of the Cross elaborates this quite a bit. And that is, clearly we think of when somebody, you know, becomes a Christian, they're baptized, they begin a life of faith, they begin praying, they begin practicing the sacraments. They begin avoiding at least mortal sins and trying to, you know, remain in the state of grace and so on. And so this is at the beginning of the way. This is sometimes called the penitential way. We're trying to avoid mortal sin, and we're hopefully going to avoid many venial sins as well, but probably we'll still have a lot to be purified in us. And the first purification is a purification of our senses. In other words, it's God's action in the soul. It's not something we can make happen in ourselves, but by a life of prayer, perhaps God will give us sufferings, even remarkable ones. Many of the saints, the stories of their dark nights, the two of them, are very remarkable, and this is particularly for those living in cloistered life. But for people in the world, the dark night of the sense can take many forms in terms of sufferings and purifications from attachment to creatures, to what our senses love. And when that is done, the battle is not over. If you're looking, again, say, in the particular patterns, which is, you know, quite familiar in the lives of the saints, this is the path to get to the mystical life, where penance and meditation give way not to no penance, but because we must do penance throughout our life, but gives way to contemplation, to drawing closer to God, to a more simplified kind of prayer. And that's called the illuminative way, in which our ideas about God acquired by study, by meditation, and so on, become more simplified and more supernaturalized in our understanding, you could say, more synthetic, and so on. And that happens in that middle way, the illuminative way. And then finally is the dark night of the soul. And this is a great trial that comes upon the person in the spiritual area. Its purpose is, even though we've given up sin and we've given up attachment to creature, yet in our spirit there can be many things still holding on, spiritual attachments, you know, pride in our physical accomplishments may have given way to a certain pride in our spiritual accomplishments and so on. But these roots of sin must be removed from the soul for us to be perfect, something Jesus said we should be perfect as the Heavenly Father is perfect. And for that, there is the dark night of the spirit. It's said that Mother Teresa experienced this for decades, and then at the end of which some people say, well, she had lost her faith, and that's far from the truth. It's precisely because a person's faith continues. It begins to be the thing that they hold on to when everything else seems missing from their life. No consolations, no nothing, but all there is God, and that pointedness, that directedness, that love and of God and the service of neighbor. And that's what she had for many, many years. So that is specifically the answer to your question. That dark night of the soul is that last purification that leads into what the mystical authors call the unitive way. This is a way where we are united with God on a particular level so strongly that it's said we are confirmed in grace. I would look at it in this way. It means that psychologically our love of God is so firm that nothing would ever detract us from Him. We have free will, but it's freely given over to God. We're totally consumed with the love of God and the service of God's children in this world. And so in that unitive way, we would be considered perfect in the that definition, so that when we die, we would go directly to heaven. So that dark night of the spirit is for many maybe what they have to go through yet in purgatory. For some, it may be that they still die in many attachments to mortal sin and venial sin, and their purgatory will be appropriate to those attachments. But our object, as Mother always used to say, is, you know, don't shoot for purgatory, you might miss. You shoot for heaven, and that's using the means that the Church gives us of prayer, penance, meditation, study, and so on, to do those things, the sacraments, to do those things which allow us to be perfect even in this world, as the Father is, so that we can go to Him directly at the end of our life.
Thanks, Linda. We appreciate the call today. That opens up a line for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Colin, we head to your home and native land. Joe is a first-time caller in Newfoundland today, listening on the EWTN app. Joe, you're on with Colin Donovan.
Hi.
Hey, Joe. Just to clarify, I'm from Saskatchewan, so not exactly a Newfie.
Canucks.
Yeah, I've been a Newfie all my life.
Yeah.
loving it.
Okay. Well, what's your question today, Joe?
My question today, sir, is about the rosary.
Okay.
And meditating on the mysteries of the rosary.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is there a recommended way to properly meditate on the mysteries of the rosary, or is it do the best we can with what we know or whatever? And is it okay, like, to use, say, what I would call holy pictures, or that depict each mystery, to keep our mind focused more on each mystery of the rosary?
Absolutely. In fact, it's generally recommended that, because we're so distractible creatures, that we have something to bring us our attention back when we start drifting off, to bring our attention back. It might be to hold and look at a crucifix. It might be to look at a holy picture, one that depicts the scene. Likewise, we can also read between the meditations if we want to read the scriptural account that refers to, you know, each of those mysteries for those that are directly connected to precise events recounted in scripture. There are also many meditation books that will do this in various ways, sometimes a meditation before the decade. I used for years a little booklet with the Daughters of St. Paul put out, which gave a little scriptural verse or a little idea from a saint for each and every bead. And it was a way of fixing the mind and keeping the meditation going, and so you didn't drift off. So anything that will allow you to concentrate and think about the mystery and the things of God connected to that mystery, which can be directly the things of God, the scriptural scene, imagining the scene, imagining being in the scene. There are all kinds of different ways which have been proposed for such meditations. Almost anything you want to do, including simply, you know, it's often about all we can get out is to say the prayer orally or even just mentally. You know, we're tired or whatever, and we're trying to say our rosary. We may doze off on it, and that too the Lord understands. So you do the best you can, but you're quite right in thinking, have something available, you know, to get you back on track when you slip off.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. I say a poorly said rosary is better than no rosary at all. Not that you should strive or settle for that, but...
Right, yeah.
833-288-3986. Tim wants to know, can two divorced Catholics who have never received decrees of nullity date each other?
Very bad idea. You form attachments, and then pretty soon you're thinking, well, you know, I want this relationship more than I want the church, more than I want the Eucharist. It's always good to at least keep things on the level of friendship. That's certainly unavoidable. Typically, you're meeting people who are in your social circle or in your workplace or whatever, that friendship. But if you're serious about a relationship, wouldn't be appropriate then to just start dating. You should get your first marriage clarified. I've heard a lot of priests say that, you know, it would be good if every couple that have broken up and definitively would look into this to see whether or not there's likely it was not a marriage to begin with, because that would be the clarity that you need to date. Otherwise, you're going down a dangerous road.
You know, it seems to be a prevailing attitude, especially here in America, of, you know, we sort of view the way the church has things set up as our fallback position after we've accomplished what we really desire to do. Not only in a situation like is described here, but you'll see people who are waiting for the church to rule on the validity of a former marriage, and they'll just get civilly married and wait. You know, it's never a bad idea to do things in the church's time.
Yeah. Right, and it betrays a very legalistic idea of marriage, frankly, that, okay, you know, the church's legal system works this way, the civil works the other way, I can, you know, use the civil system while waiting on the church. When you think that marriage is a mystery of Christ and the church, it should receive that reverence from those who are thinking of it, that the church and St. Paul speaks of.
It's EWTN's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Congratulations going out to our great EWTN radio partner, St. Gabriel Communications, serving Garden City, Kansas, celebrating 9 years as an EWTN affiliate. Congratulations to James Janda and the whole team at KSGC from your friends here at EWTN Radio. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Still time for your calls at 833-288-3986. Next up is Jenny in Spokane, Washington, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Jenny, you are on with Colin Donovan.
Well, hi there, fellas. How are you today?
Well, pretty good. What's your question today?
I'm a little nervous to ask because I don't want to be offensive to our Lord, but my question is, do you think, Donovan, that the Pope or the Church would ever allow the flesh of the miracle of Lanciano to be tested for DNA? And my mind is just goes to whether or not there would just be one strand of DNA from the Davidic line,
mm-hmm.
or what would we find? You know, that's just my question.
Well, I don't know that it wouldn't, but I don't know that there's also any rush to do it. The Eucharistic miracles stand on their own. They're already remarkable. They're already inexplicable. For instance, in the case of Lanciano, when it was tested at a laboratory at Rome in the 60s, the constituency of the blood was that of a living body, not a dead body, although it had been on the preserved since the 800s, or since the 1200s. So it's hard to imagine how living blood could be present in a vial for 800 years. So I think they're remarkable on their own. As for what DNA testing might show, that's also hard to know because we're assuming that God would desire a standing miracle. Clearly, only the human nature of Mary was used, thus as Eve corrupted our human nature. Mary gave to the Redeemer her human nature, which was from its beginning immaculately conceived and sinless, not only to the moment of the incarnation, but to the end of her life. So we know that the paternity there of Joseph's is a legal paternity. He was of the priestly line as well as the kingly line. Mary was likely of a priestly line as her cousin Elizabeth and her husband was. And so we know that that is what validates and satisfies the scriptural, you know, of he would be priest and king, the Messiah would be priest and king. I don't know that God, what he might do in that case, because he could create the whole other half of the genome if he wanted, or he could simply duplicate Mary's half and create a Y chromosome, or do it without any of those as a pure miracle. So I think we would have to have a DNA result in order to see how he did it. And I think in such a case, we would ponder, well, what are the implications of that? But we believe that Christ is the Lord by the proofs of his life, by the prophetic prefigurements, by the miracles that he did, and by the gift of divine faith. And I don't know what knowing the DNA is would do. We have a great many people who are not convinced of the supernatural, despite Lanciano, despite the shroud, which is a mystery which continues to defy scientific explanation, and many others. So would God condescend to the to the skeptical in order to convince them when all those things are present already in the church? At Lourdes, you know, almost 100 medically improbable. The medical teams have declared these do not have any scientific explanation. They are beyond explanation. In every canonization, a miracle to be beatified, a miracle to be canonized. The evidences of the supernatural are everywhere for those who have the eyes to see and the heart open and willing to believe. Is God obliged then to go so far as to produce a genetic miracle to satisfy their desire for evidence? I don't think so, because I think many of them would simply not believe. And he also taught, Christ taught, do not to scatter your pearls before swine. And I'm not sure that he would satisfy that longing. So I don't know that it would add anything, but if it ever done, we can ponder the results when they're released.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Still time for your phone calls. Next up is Fred in the great state of Missouri, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Fred, you are on with Colin Donovan.
Thank you. When Jesus was here on this earth, mm-hmm. did he go around and tell people, I want penance, penance, penance?
In a manner, way he did, he started off his ministry by spending 40 days doing penance in the desert. He was preceded by the last of the prophets, John the Baptist, who greatly encouraged people to repent of their sins by doing penance, who himself lived a very penitential life. So we have that example. He constantly told people, take up your cross and follow me. For most people, taking up their cross is not going to be taking up a big hunk of wood and carrying it through town and being put to death on it. It's going to be dealing not just with the ordinary trials and tribulations of life, but also with the greater ones, which require a degree of steeling of the will. And finally, in the Gospel of Luke, in chapter 13, he said, you know, unless you do penance, you will perish, or words to that effect. One other example is when his disciples were chastised because they didn't do penance as the Jewish tradition prescribed, as the disciples of the Pharisees did and others, the penances of that. He himself was from Nazareth, which recalls in our mind the Nazarene vow, which was a very penitential way. So there's all these kinds of things. But when he was asked why your disciples don't do penance, they say, do you do penance? Well, the bridegroom is ready here. But after he has departed, they will do penance. So after the ascension, the church has taught continuously that we must do penance or perish. And part of that is to our human nature. The angels don't have to do penance. In fact, the fallen angels, if they did penance, it would serve them no good. Their intellects and wills are entirely fixed on their destination, their goal, whether it's God or the case of the good angels, or whether it's self in the case of the devil and the fallen angels. But we are creatures of mixed nature, spiritual and material, and are, because of original sin and the rebellion of our senses, we are always fighting a war with our nature. And that's the reason we have to do penance. So everything comes together to encourage us to do penance, including the 2,000-year tradition of the church.
833-288-EWTN's our toll-free number. We've still got time for your calls and some open phone lines at 833-288-3986. Lee would like to know, did the flood in Genesis flood the whole world or just the known world?
Well, that's a debate that hasn't been resolved in any geological, meteorological, or other sense. I think the church doesn't hold to the creationist position that, you know, history is encompasses only the 6,000 years since the creation, or near to be. I think the actual count is, if you use the Jewish calendar, which purports to be from creation, that in about 120 years we will have reached the 600 years of since creation.
6,000.
6,000 years since creation, yeah. Something like in 2224 or something like that. So, but the church doesn't necessarily take that. So you see, certainly I think up until modern times and what science could discover, the church simply held to what had been handed down through various cultures. At least that in the Mediterranean basis, there was some kind of cataclysmic flood is affirmed in Babylonian myths and even in archaeological discoveries that show that. Purported discoveries of Noah's Ark, which are spoken of in the Babylonian myths as well as in the Bible. So there's clearly tradition in the Mediterranean basis, and especially in the Middle East, of a widespread flood. And that is likely the origin of the tradition, the flood tradition, written down at some point in Israelite history. Could be at the time of Moses. The rabbis attribute to Moses the five books, yet they were not written down probably until well after Moses. So we don't know exactly the origins of that. But it teaches us certainly a moral lesson, and that is that, you know, historically mankind has failed to live up to what God has asked it to do and what was revealed to our first parents. It was then in the egotism, the Tower of Babel and the flood and all these things that as punishments. And the inevitable curative after all the warnings and all of the trials and tribulations that fall on people, the inevitable is that God finally punishes in some very dramatic way. And so I think that's the lesson it teaches, and it's a lesson that I think our own generation could learn as we wander down the ways of ancient disaster.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Still time for your calls and some open lines for you as well. Stay informed and educated with the latest news and truth on abortion, euthanasia, assisted suicide, and the entire culture of death. And we can even send you EWTN's Pro-Life Weekly directly to your email inbox. Be educated. Visit EWTN.com and click on subscribe. 833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Mary writes in, are writings necessary for canonization of a saint? Is it necessary for them to have written documents?
No, and it was the beggar of Rome, Saint Labouré, I think it was. Henry Labouré? He was...
Is that Catherine's brother? Or?
No. Labra, I can pronounce the last name. Somebody on staff here will look that up. But he was basically the beggar of Rome, known to everybody, but was actually very holy and very devout, and probably intellectually and otherwise challenged. And as far as I know, he didn't leave any writings, and many do not. No, the writings come into play if you've written. And if you've written and they analyze your life and they document your life, as all of the saints will, the effort of the local tribunal, the one established by a diocese to begin a cause and to lead it, you know, to gather all the information about the individual, that will include all of their writings. And, of course, in our digital age, that will include all of those kinds of things as well, no doubt, you know, audio, video, social media, and so on. So maybe that's a warning. Anyone on social media wants to, you know, preview their own canonization process, they might look at what we're saying on social media.
It's Saint Benoit Joseph Labouré.
That's who it is. That's right. Benedict Joseph LeBray. Yeah. There we go.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Tuesday is Election Day here in the United States. It's a presidential election year. Probably be a good time from a theological and a church teaching perspective to sort of review the responsibilities of a Catholic when it comes to these sorts of civil responsibilities.
Sure. And we, first of all, to note that we do have this and on at least two different websites, EWTNnews.com and EWTN.com. On EWTN.com, it's Slant Vote. We'll bring you that material. I forget what the link is, but I'm sure if you go to the EWTNnews.com page, you will see immediately a link to the voting. And there, not only the general theology, but also the positions of the major candidates. And for most of us nationally, it's the one we share in common. That's the presidential and vice presidential candidates. So I think the important thing to know is that barring a non-consequential election when you have two good candidates, for the most part, Catholics have the obligation to vote. They have the moral obligation from the general moral law that we have a debt of gratitude we owe to our country. And in democracies, that usually means participation democratically, which is principally to vote, but can also include, you know, writing our representatives and complaining about things that are bad and encouraging things that are good. So there's all kinds of ways that can take. But the principal way is to vote, and the church encourages that, and our Holy See has encouraged that in our bishops' conference as well. And that's part of the long moral theology tradition on the matters, on that matter. This obligation of piety or of patriotism, as it's generally called with respect to nations. Secondly, as I noted, unless there is, you know, a non-consequential election when you could just simply stay home and it doesn't matter, or not vote on a candidate because they're equally good. When there's a consequential election, in particular offices, then there should be a general, you know, leaning towards having a duty to vote. And that is the outcome of the nation, the final vote, the ultimate vote, is going to, may depend upon your vote, and so therefore to take that obligation seriously. Sadly, the United States has often have one of the lowest voting participations in the world compared to some other countries, and that may be, I don't know, sure in the Catholic countries would compare there, but it's an obligation we have to take seriously. And so where there is a consequential election, you may have candidates who are not saints, or their policies are not perfect, or do not meet the standards of moral theology or social teaching or whatever it is, but you have to make an analysis. The preponderance of good that would be accomplished by the election of one candidate versus the preponderance that would come as a result of the election of the other. And again, particularly if the preponderance of the election of the other candidate is negative on things which the church holds in greatest esteem and importance, such as life, natural marriage and family life, and the support of that institution as both the natural law and God has defined it, and the liberty and the responsibility of parents to raise their children and the liberty to do that and to make decisions about their education and maturation, not to have the government do that for you. That would be the third pillar of that. So where the preponderance is towards evil, that gives you a clear direction as well. When you have a, you know, one way or the other doesn't make a difference, then yeah, you vote whichever one you think is best. But you look for those kinds of things, recognizing that we can't simply say, well, I'm not going to vote, and then the outcome is on other people's heads. No, the outcome will be morally on our head for not doing our responsibilities, and especially if an evil candidate, one who will be against life, family, and religious liberty, were to be elected.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Nick's watching us on YouTube, and he says, are there enough validly ordained bishops who know the extraordinary form of the Roman Rite to keep it alive for those priests who want it? It appears that the old form isn't taught in seminaries.
No,
Not true, first of all.
Is it?
Yeah, the priestly fraternity of St. Peter.
And right, the but other, they have the
they have their own seminary that teaches the extraordinary.
Right, form, and so. But I think he means in like diocesan seminaries, it's not generally taught.
No.
But I think you know, I'm not exactly sure how this worked. This was not a question or issue that came up when I was in my seminary and thinking of the priesthood era. But I think I've heard of men, well, they'll find an older priest if they wish to learn the traditional forms and learn it with them or have them, you know, instruct them. And the other groups will do that as well. I think they would help a diocesan clergy to do that. But it's certainly true that as the church has a liturgical rite, which she generally wants to be universal, such that the toleration of other rites is that it's a toleration. I would say that the church has tolerated a variety of different rites. The Ambrosian is still with us. The Mozarabic is not celebrated often, if it is at all, in Toledo, Spain. The Braga rite, similarly, in Braga, Portugal. These are all ancient rites. The Dominicans have their own rite, which is similar to the Tridentine. I'm not sure; those priests are probably some of them still around who celebrate it. But the Church has tolerance for all of those kinds of things, which are historical, and hopefully, I think that tolerance can continue for those who love the extraordinary form as well. That would require new decisions, I think, on the part of the Holy See, and God willing, those might come about at some point.
Ephraim, also watching us on YouTube, wants to know why the Pope is referred to as His Holiness.
Because he's the principal minister of the holy things of our Lord. So it refers to the responsibilities and the duties in the office which he protects. And it's also, you know, somewhat like in England, we say Your Honor for judges, but I think in some offices it's, you know, Your Worship or things like this. It's traditional forms of veneration that are carried on because tradition does that. It serves that purpose as a connection between different, can be two completely different eras, but the fact that the same institutions persevere and survive and go on and the same traditions are followed, as they are in England with the Whigs and things like that for lawyers, this has value in and of itself. And so the use of, Your Holiness or Your Beatitude for some offices, higher offices in the church, patriarchs of different churches and so on, these are traditional forms that perpetuate that recognition of the significance and importance of the office. And hopefully the office holders are up to living the implications of those titles given to them.
It's not just England, you canuck.
Where? Well,
there's still some Whigs floating around Canada.
Probably in Australia and other places as well.
Chuck is in the great state of Washington listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Chuck's just a couple minutes left. What's your question today for Colin?
Real quick question about what Jesus was referring to when he said, well, it would be better to have a millstone tied around your neck if you cause a child to sin. Was Jesus referencing those who cause children to sin in today's society, such as those who...
Yeah, I think I get the gist of your question, and I'll jump into it given the time available here. I think he intended it for all generations. His words are universal and golden throughout history. And it's just a general principle. If you cause scandal to anybody, it's a sin of the equal quality to the sin. If you cause the scandal of supporting abortion, don't think you haven't done anything, that you're not, you know, you're not a murderer. That sin of scandal is the equal of the mortal sin of doing abortion. So any kind of sinful scandal is going to be equal. Children who are innocent, he's talking about the destruction of that innocence by leading them down the paths of sin. And that's particularly evil because the children are starting out in life, and the job of adults, parents, and others in their life is to guide them to a great moral beginning to their life and a continuation of it till their death.
On behalf of our host, Colin Donovan, producer Michael McCall, call screener Matt Kubensky, and our social media maven, Mr. Ace McKay, I'm Jack Williams. Thanks for another great week of EWTN's Open Line. Back at it again on Monday. Until then, have a great weekend, and God bless.